Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to this episode number 89 of the Free Cities Podcast. Well, apologies this morning if my voice sounds a little strange. I'm struggling a bit with a rather nasty throat infection. Not sure where it came from. Might be something to do with this balmy, balmy summer weather, which is still raging on here in the UK. It's been hot and sweaty for quite a while now. Not that I'm complaining, of course. And in fact, today it kind of feels like it might be the day that the heavens finally open up at some point and flush out all the dusty heat with a tremendous downpour. Let's see. Anyway, talking of downpours, I have a deluge of great content for you today. Did you like that segue? Probably not. Nor did I, to be honest. Anyway, a few weeks ago, I got to sit down with a gentleman by the name of Alan Farrington. Now, the Bitcoiners amongst you will know him very well. He's the co-author of the book Bitcoin is Venice, a very well-respected book about modern economic theories, both the good ones and the bad ones. The title of the book does, in fact, come from one of his previous essays in which he connects the properties of Venice, which led to it becoming arguably the most successful city of all time, with the attributes of the monetary technology of Bitcoin. As you may guess, Alan thinks that Bitcoin could be pivotal in helping us to usher in a new age of governance and economic realities on the planet. In this conversation, we discuss Venice's 1,000 plus year success story and its final demise, along with his take on the sovereign individual thesis that we see playing out in front of ourselves at this particular moment in history. We also talk about the importance of letting go of our fiat monetary system. Alan is most certainly someone who uses the word fiat as an adjective. Myself included. Anyway, all in all, this is a super interesting conversation at what I would call the intersection of free cities and Bitcoin. So thanks to Alan for taking the time to drop in and bring his unique wisdom to us. And thank you all for taking the time to listen each week. I appreciate all your comments and messages. And also many thanks to those of you who've been very generously boosting the podcast via the Fountain app recently. And if you're someone who hasn't yet discovered the value for value way of consuming podcasts, well, get yourself over to your preferred app store and download the Fountain app and become part of the community helping to create a new system for rewarding creators directly. It's most certainly the future, as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, podcast at free-cities.org to contact me directly. I see everything that comes through that channel. And of course, in the meantime, while I nurse my painful throat, enjoy the content just by sitting back, relaxing, and enjoying my conversation with Alan Farrington. Interestingly, because I've just been speaking to Tour Demeester, and I've got a lot of respect for him, as you probably have as well.
Oh, absolutely.
He said that your book should be in libraries and should be given to students studying Bitcoin, which I thought was a really quite amazing thing to say.
I gave him a copy of the transcript before it came out. I gave a handful of copy because we were sourcing blurbs. And his actually didn't make it on because he didn't. I feel like I'm throwing him under the bus immediately, but he didn't finish it in time for the production deadline.
He told me that as well.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Good. Well, he threw himself under the bus already. That's fine. But he then he did. I think he partly probably because he felt guilty about that. He promoted it for us nonetheless on Twitter and said things about it so nice that. I mean, I believe him, obviously. I don't think he was just faking it out of guilt or whatever, but I think he liked it more than I did. He liked it a lot, which is, he's obviously immense respect for him. So I'm very grateful for not only the advertisement, but, you know, just the reaction it got from him. But I quite honestly don't understand why he likes it that much.
Well, he said it was the view from very far away. It was the real overall view. And he said that you described financial systems, like financial philosophies, very well. And he said that there were a lot that he'd never even heard of before.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I can see him appreciating that. That's very... I was going to say helpful feedback. Maybe we have second edition one day. That's a very, in my view at least, accurate analysis, which I enormously appreciate. And maybe it's worth, should we give a bit of context about how the book even came about? Because I don't talk about it all that often.
I will be doing an introduction, but yes, the book is Bitcoin is Venice.
Yeah.
And according to ChatGPT, I asked it because I thought, I wonder if it has read all these things by the looks of it now. Like 3 months ago, ChatGPT wouldn't have known, probably. It's relatively obscure, but now it seemed to, it just...
Yeah. What did it say?
It gave 4 points, but it said... it compared Bitcoin with Venice, obviously. I mean, it could have worked this one out from the title and gave the reasons why. And it said, for example, it was decentralized. It empowered the traders. Mm-hmm. Did I write it down? It was a center of innovation. Mm-hmm. And so it empowered the merchant, center of innovation, decentralized structure. And the first one, I think, was then a mix of all the other things together.
I think ChatGPT might be confused, to be completely honest, because you're describing one section of one chapter of the book. So what I think has actually happened is that it has read the essay that became that chapter and not the book.
Right.
Which, even that's kind of a fun segue into describing the context for the book, because Bitcoin is Venice as a title, even of the original essay, is kind of clickbait. I thought it was a good title. I thought it was kind of catchy and like it became, I mean, the essay itself was a lot more successful than I was expecting, kind of became its own brand, which then it seemed was an obvious thing to try to harness for then writing the book, especially knowing that we wanted to include this chapter and the other essays that were linked to it. But it is, it's quite funny that that's what ChatGPT thinks.
Give us the 101 then. Give us from the horse's mouth the 101 then.
Well, this is why I liked your mentioning Turr's assessment of it, because we can come back to, I assume you want to come back to the comparison to Venice in particular and what that single, not even chapter, but that section in that chapter is about. But the book as a whole, I think, is about something completely different. Also worth mentioning for context, I have a co-author. That's why I keep saying we, in terms of, you know, we meant this, we wrote that. The co-author is a very good friend of mine who I met because we both started our TradFi jobs on the same day, where we did the same job. We were in the same, you know, intake. He still has that job. I have since left to go full-time Bitcoin. But he's, you know, he's pretty orange-pilled as well, as you could probably imagine.
He's got a job. I haven't. I've gone full Bitcoin.
I'm self-employed. That's way cooler, in my opinion. I mean, it comes with its trade-offs. I'm not sure I'd recommend it for everybody. But so co-author is a friend of mine who still works in TradFi, is a Bitcoiner, but also... I'm setting the scene that way because a lot of what ended up in the book is basically our distillation of conversations that we had been having for 4 or 5 years at that point. And if anything, the book was a nudge to, or the process of writing the book was a nudge to actually write this stuff down. and try to make it more rigorous too, because you know, conversations very sort of ethereal, they just float around, they don't need to be all that rigorous. But on topics that in part stemmed from our jobs, but which the more we dove into them, the more we thought probably have ramifications elsewhere. And so what I mean by that is our jobs were, well, his job still is, my job was an investor. So very simply just thinking about whether companies, in our case, because we're investing in public equities, as opposed to, you know, commodities or whatever else, thinking about whether companies are good investments. However, if you are given the breadth to think about this topic, you know, if you're not just churning out reports, which are, I think, are my former employer, his current employer, we're very good at, you know, giving you space and time to think about what you're actually doing, rather than just being, you know, like a, you know, on the hamster wheel or whatever. I think it's inevitable. I mean, other friends of ours who are still there, you know, we're helpful in this process too. But it's inevitable that you start thinking about, you know, the role of capital markets more broadly. And then especially if you're also a Bitcoiner, right? If you're, or even maybe don't identify that way, but have thought somewhat seriously about Bitcoin, somewhat seriously about Austrian economics, are aware of the fiat scam, you do start thinking about the impact of your work beyond, you know, the narrow confines of exactly, oh, I think we should invest in this company, we shouldn't invest in that one. And us teasing that out over, originally, as I said, in conversation, several years, you know, where else can these lessons apply, is basically what then became the book. So it's, again, going back to why I laugh at ChatGPT's summary of it, is that Bitcoin is Venice. Even Bitcoin, actually, even having Bitcoin in the title is kind of clickbait, because it's not really about Bitcoin. It's more about Bitcoin than you know, not at all, I guess, or than it isn't, because in the background of everything that we discuss is that we kind of assume that Bitcoin is monetizing as we speak, and that it will have an impact eventually on probably everything that we cover, just insofar as, you know, money is half of every trade, and therefore, you know, I'm trying to think how to even bring this back in a relatively concise way. What the book is mainly about is having analyzed the concept of capital, what we think is appropriately, you can't help but, on the one hand, extend a lot of the argumentation to other areas of life, of social endeavors that aren't necessarily economic. But on the other, you also can't help but appreciate how fundamental money is, at the very least, to, you know, finance and economics, but also probably to these other areas too. So that's kind of wrapping up the, not only the thesis of the book, but why it is even in part about Bitcoin, because a lot of what we're critically analyzing is, you know, how fiat has broken everything. And even without a lot of the discussion being explicitly about Bitcoin, the assumption that, you know, when we get a hard money again, these institutions, whatever they are, whether it's finance on the one hand or things that are far more abstract on the other, will probably also improve.
Let's start then. Let's enter the book via what you know about Venice, I think.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Because I can see that as the easiest route in. Mm. And I'm talking here about, you know, the actual place that you as a citizen of Venice in the medieval age, what was it like? And what did you discover from sort of like...
I think you've got to be careful with this, that is, your life was probably horrible compared to now. So that's not so much the point we're making. It's as compared to certainly anywhere else in its immediate vicinity, arguably anywhere else in the world at that time. Be a bit more specific, I guess that time would be starting early 14th century and then building up to what we would now refer to as the Renaissance. A couple of hundred years at least, where Venice was arguably the leading light of certainly European Mediterranean civilization, but in hindsight, knowing the course of world history, pivotal to everything that followed. And so as a citizen of Venice at the time, you would have encountered several things that simply did not exist anywhere else, really. You would have encountered a remarkably stable political system that effectively gave you property rights. With a lot of these things, I want to be a little bit careful not to overly romanticize it, you know, keeping in mind this is 600-700 years ago, so it's not maybe what we would be perfectly happy with today, but gives you property rights, protects you, probably most importantly, is, I would say, I guess, the safest place in the world in terms of resisting state aggression, certainly. And the link, well, one of the many links to Bitcoin that the title of the section and the article and the book is predicated on is this, I think, quite cute connection between both Bitcoin and Venice in completely different ways, which is, I think, what makes it kind of fun, being very, very difficult to attack and very, very easy to defend, very cheap to defend, maybe more to the point. And so we can maybe get on separately to how that applies to Bitcoin. But in the case of Venice, it's a feature of its geography, mainly, you know, the fact that it's in a lagoon, with the military technology that existed for several hundred years, really up until around 1800 or so, it was nearly impossible to effectively attack. And it, in fact, was, you know, Venice was an independent political republic for a good, oh, what even is it? I should know this better. I want to say over 1,000 years,
it
I think 1,100 years or so.
1,000 years, yes.
Yeah. Mainly for this reason, that it's so incredibly difficult to attack that nobody did. That's not true. Once or twice they came close, but it really is remarkable in world history, and it's completely a, by and large, let's say, it's a feature of its coincidental feature of its geography. But what's interesting that obviously follows from that is you touched on a couple of these points before, what that allows in terms of social institutions building on that relative peace and prosperity, political stability, and then that naturally enough, I think, leads to economic expansion, and ultimately that then leads to, or in maybe it's not quite as deterministic, but in the case of Venice, led to cultural flourishing, with Venice and arguably Florence as well being the catalyst for the Renaissance. But I think tracing that is important because I think in the wider public consciousness, you know, as in nothing connected to Bitcoin or even economic history so much, a lot of more naive, let's say, historical discourse around the Renaissance acts as if it was random, as if it was just this, you know, the spontaneous event, which I think is not only wrong, but foolish in a way too, because I think once you have a more, it feels a bit cringy to say, but, you know, interdisciplinary appreciation, I think these arguments around not only economics, but politics, and then maybe even going right back to, I don't know if you wanted to go in this direction necessarily, but a lot of my sources for this, which I'm happy to go into and recommend to your audience, came from The Sovereign Individual, the book, but not as in not from the book itself, from other, basically from that book's bibliography. And in particular, there's an expression that I think is well known more or less exclusively because of The Sovereign Individual, but returns on violence, which actually comes from, I mean, they're open about this. I'm not saying they were misleading. It's just that's what that book is where most people associate the phrase and the way they reason about it, because they extend the reasoning quite a lot. But it originally comes from an economic historian called Frederick Lane, whose specialty was medieval Venice. And most of the arguments he makes, he has a few essays where he talks about this more in general, but his own thinking developed around why what happened in Venice did in the first place. And even there, I'll maybe wrap up on this point. There's interesting connections to Bitcoin in that you can, you know, you can see it as a cultural event or phenomenon. You can see it as a cultural phenomenon, which is valid, but that in turn depends on economic circumstances, which in turn, you know, you can go all the way down in a very similar way and realize that actually there are quite fundamental physical truths at play here that form the bedrock of everything else that, you know, all the happy consequences that we like about it, in a very similar way to Venice.
Can we break down, I want to go into the political stability mm-hmm. element here. Obviously, me personally, I'm particularly interested in how much of that was on account of the governance model.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's so, another really quite amusing comparison.
Okay, well, let's hear then. What was the governance model and what created this stability of political system?
The funniest thing about the governance model is that I don't remember the details, and I honestly highly doubt anybody does. Maybe one or two historians can actually recite exactly what happened. The reason being, it'll become obvious when I say it, that there's a number of, well, numbers, basically, there's a range of numbers involved in this model, you know, parameters, let's say, which I find funny on account of how random they appear to be. And I'm honestly not sure how much thought was even put into calibrating them as such. I kind of feel like they were probably chosen to just be as ridiculous as possible. So with that set up, this is more or less the governance model for Venice. So the background that we have to keep in mind is that it's, again, mindful of, you know, how sensibilities have moved on in the 600-700 years, still remarkably ahead of its time. It was relatively, I guess you'd call it, oligopolistic, also aristocratic, but with a very strong commercial bent. So in the sense that there were numerous, I don't think royal would be quite the right way of putting it, but aristocratic families who had commercial dynasties who were all to some extent vying for power within Venice. But which there were enough of them, you know, it's maybe tempting to compare it to kind of modern day political parties, for example, which may be valid for somewhere like Germany, I suppose, certainly not the UK or, you know, the US. There were many, many families. There were many factions and alliances and so on. So it's important to appreciate that as a starting point. But the way the system was designed was to make it as difficult as possible, if not basically just impossible on account of how ridiculous it is, for any, certainly single family, but even faction of families to gain power over anybody else. And I think broadly there was an appreciation that the point of this was to benefit the Republic as a whole. And even there, that thinking is very, very much ahead of its time. And you could argue, I guess, even though it's still firmly within the political realm, requires some kind of economic appreciation to come up with in the first place and to value and to have ingrained in the culture, which I think is also actually natural, because all of these families, all these factions were first and foremost merchants. So this kind of positive sum thinking is sort of obvious for, you know, to their benefit. They didn't think in terms of, they recognized the risks of it being possible to, you know, amass power and push others out, but they appreciated that it's not in any, it's arguably not even in the interest of whoever could try to do that. It's in everybody's interest to have mechanisms in place to resist it. So with that in mind, this is the governance procedure or something to this effect. They had various different legislative bodies, which were all drawn from these families. So, you know, you had to be noble, basically, to qualify. But then in terms, and there were different sizes and they had different responsibilities for different, you know, various administrative affairs of the city. But it was the Doge, which is probably the position that people will be familiar with. Basically king, but Doge is nicer word, I guess. Sounds cooler, I think, than king. The Doge was selected by various electoral means from within these councils. And this is where it gets funny in terms of the parameters. So it was something like the following. You start off with the main body, which I think was 300 or 400 or so nobles. They would all vote and whoever got the, but they'd all vote for multiple different, you know, candidates as such. Whoever got the top 40 votes would then move to the next stage. But that group of 40, what they would do is amongst them decide the next 80 from the original body. So they then decide the 80. Then you get this 80, and then you go back to the original 300-400, and they vote on whittling that 80 down to 15. And then that 15, and basically this just goes on like forever and ever. So you see what I mean, that I don't remember. I'm just making up these numbers because I know they're roughly right. I doubt anyone actually knows all of these numbers. Maybe like one or two historians can guide you through this and get everything right, right? And be accurate for the whole process. But basically this just goes on in terms of going back and forward between voting and choosing and voting and choosing, blah, 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 blah. And then eventually the numbers are kind of gradually getting smaller. They go up and down and up and down. But eventually it's something like, you know, there's five people and everybody votes on who gets to be the Doge from those five. And so it's so ridiculous on purpose so as to make it impossible to game. You can imagine, I didn't even describe the whole thing because I don't know it, but you can imagine there's some family, some faction, whatever, who's like, we got to get our guy in and then we'll really be on top. And like, how do you do that? You just can't possibly. There's no way you can possibly game this system to get your guy in, which is ideal. And it's, do you want me to make the connection to Bitcoin really quickly as well?
Before we do.
Okay.
Because I've never heard that before. And I think,
it's awesome, isn't it? Imagine that's how it worked today. That's exactly how we get the Prime Minister.
This is my question, because Venice was arguably one of the most successful cities of all time that we know of.
I think so, yeah.
So why don't we see something similar in governance?
Yeah,
today?
Very good question. Because it returns on violence, I think. I think it's it was only possible because of everything that we covered a few minutes ago, a few questions ago. It was stable only on account of purely coincidental, I'll say physical factors. I said geographical before, but it's the physical reality that really matters. And also that's abstract enough that you can describe Bitcoin in the same way, I think, or describe, you know, any political institution will ultimately come down to this. And that's the sovereign individual thesis in a nutshell. But if anything, yes, it was very successful, but it was also highly, highly anomalous historically. So yeah, I guess if I'm tempted, I don't know how sort of fluffy and hippie-ish it's even worth being, but if people were better, right, if they were just nicer, if they weren't as violent, then you wouldn't need this starting point, and maybe every city could develop in that direction.
I wonder which is more important, the position of Venice as a stronghold, very hard to attack, or the governance model.
Well, I think they're all intertwined. I think that's why it's interesting. So the governance model itself depends on the, I'd argue in part the culture, but in part the economic reality, and they're obviously intertwined, right? Because the people who are more successful within the society will be largely guiding the culture anyway, and then the culture will influence how they behave and how they move the society along. That's all, for Venice at least, and probably in most cases, that's highly dependent on their success as merchants. I don't think I've used this expression yet, but it's, or was, completely common to refer to Venice as a mercantile republic. I think that's key. I don't think you can't just drop this governance model into a random collection of people and expect it to work. It's fine-tuned to where and how and when it was deployed, which I think makes all of those factors, which in a sense are more fundamental, all the more interesting, because you see what the results are, right? I mean, obviously, I highly doubt, you know, no matter how widely people can disagree politically, they're never going to disagree with like, oh, we want our society to flourish. We want everyone to do well. They obviously disagree about the means for that. But that's exactly why I think it's so instructive, because the combination of how disproportionately successful it was, and just how, you know, we mentioned this before, how influential that disproportionate success ended up being in truly world history, forces you to think a bit more clearly, I think a bit more tangibly about, okay, what are the real world circumstances that even can create this, rather than just, you know, purely abstract hand waving about, oh, wouldn't it be great if this happened or that happened, and then, you know, then you get communism basically. So
I mean, it's, I keep thinking about the UAE at the moment, because I've been there, going out there a lot recently, and when you're in there you realize everyone who's a citizen there is making money. Mm-hmm. No one cares. There's no politics. There's nothing. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, there's a parallel to be drawn there. The government.
It's a pretty obvious parallel. Yeah. Runs, I think Singapore as well.
Yeah. You run your city on account.
And they basically are city states. I mean, I know the UAE is slightly more politically complicated, but it's a federation of city states effectively.
I mean, Dubai.
And Singapore just is.
Just call Dubai. Then pick on Dubai itself. I mean, there are, you know, I see a lot of similarities, but
yeah.
So talk a little bit then about, I don't want to rush ahead, but actually talk about how that it corresponds to the Bitcoin thesis then.
Oh, sure. This is really simple. And again, all of these, I want to stress, cause we kind of jump straight into it, that none of these analogies, well, Bitcoin is Venice is the high level, you know, metaphor at play here, but even drawing out the similarities, they're not serious, right? I'm not, at no point am I suggesting Bitcoin is actually Venice. It's more, it's a romantic metaphor. It's helpful rhetoric to nudge thinking about exactly these issues. So just getting clear on that. But the similarity with the governance model, I think it's pretty straightforward. It's just that it is extremely difficult, if not impossible, to actively influence Bitcoin's governance to achieve a desired political end. The mechanism is obviously completely different, but the rationale is quite similar as well, right? It has a, Bitcoin has, to the extent it even exists, it's maybe even more interesting in Bitcoin's case, to the extent there even is such a thing as Bitcoin governance, it is very opaque and difficult to engage with really in any way other than honesty. You know, if you want to influence the direction of Bitcoin, pretty much the only thing you can do is articulate your ideas well and hope people care. Not quite the same as Venice, but similar in terms of the effect.
I mean, only not the same as Venice in as much as you had to be in the nobility to effect a change. Is that what you mean? Because I mean, there are still similarities there, I think.
Such as?
Well, the nobility could affect change, and they would get together and do this crazy toing and froing and come up with someone to say, okay, let's make a change, which is kind of how the consensus mechanism works in a way. You know?
In a way, yeah. I think what I would emphasize more, though, I mean, obviously there will be, you know, there's changes in Venetian governance, there's changes in Bitcoin governance as well. It's healthy to some extent. I mean, that's, again, I don't want to get too philosophical about it, I suppose, but
why not?
In some sense, well, because it just becomes detached from reality, but no, in some sense, that's what governance even means in the first place, right? It's like the management of whatever change is going to happen in the first place. But I think there's two things I would emphasize in both cases. So these are relevant similarities. One is that as a result of all of this, changes are very slow, which I would argue is very healthy in almost any realm, probably. I think this actually goes back to, I don't want to jump around too much, but this is a central thesis of Bitcoin is Venice, the book as a whole, and we apply this in multiple different domains, that we're kind of going out our way a little bit to be contrarian on this point and make almost every, at least standard political persuasion, at least a little bit uncomfortable, not to insult people, obviously, but just to make them reflect that on the one hand, complete stasis and inability to change of any social institution, because remember, that's kind of the setting that that's what we're trying to address, you know, however arrogantly, complete stasis is very likely unhealthy because things do change. Reality changes, and institutions ought to be able to change to, you know, adapt to whatever the new circumstances are. On the other hand, too rapid change is arguably also unhealthy. There can be more reasons why, I guess. It's maybe a bit more complicated to explain in any totality, but very likely because it isn't reacting to actual feedback. It's reacting to ideas about maybe what should be rather than what actually is. So with that in mind, I think both of these are extremely relevant to certainly to Bitcoin and in a more contemporary circumstance, but amusingly similar to the political issues that Venetians would have had anyway. That it's the, you know, I mentioned stability a couple of times, political stability in particular, but that lending itself to a very healthy economic environment. That in large part depends, I think, pretty straightforwardly on not even knowing, you know, what the pace of change is going to be, but just knowing if there is change, it'll be gradual, it'll be slow, we'll have time to prepare for it. And hence, this is maybe a you'll like this link, right? And hence, we can think long term. We can afford to think over a very, very long time horizon around how this institution is going to work, because we can bank on exactly that happy middle ground, right? Like, it's not going to turn around and be completely different tomorrow and then all our plans are ruined. But also we can trust that if it does need to change, it will.
I can't help then move on to the notion that we live in a low time preference world at the moment in the West here.
Do you mean high time?
Sorry, higher time preference.
It's hard though, isn't it? I always have to pause and think about which one is which.
Someone should invent a better version of it. Yes, we're in a high time preference world, the fiat world. Don't think we're agreed that that's the...
I agree.
Okay, good. Some people have a thing about that word. I quite like it.
What,
I think
fiat?
Calling things fiat. They're kind of
I love
the
it.
Adjective.
I absolutely love it.
Me
that's,
too.
I think by the time your audience listens to this, I think my talk from... Well, so we're in Prague right now. I'm sure you'll say this in the introduction anyway, but we're at the Prague conference, and my talk at the conference, which the last I checked hasn't been put on YouTube, but it probably will have by then. If anybody goes and watches that, they will see that I have no problem whatsoever calling things fiat, and in fact encourage everybody to do it all the time.
Okay, good. I'm on board with that. So what's the connection between the democratic system and fiat things then, according to you?
To be honest, I don't feel particularly strongly about this, but I appreciate what the arguments are and that a lot of Bitcoiners do. Basically, that when you have regular elections, politicians are incentivized to only think, you know, at the most over their term length, but arguably more over whatever period of time is enough to ensure that they get reelected. So that's, on the one hand, the governance model is skewed towards shorter term thinking. But also, I think where it gets really insidious is the extent to which that reflexively influences the culture being governed in the first place, in that if people are, you know, if it's, you know, popular democracy in the first place, right, everybody has a vote, then combined with the first incentive, you get an additional incentive for the governance acts in the first place to basically be buying votes, right? To use the power of the state to, you know, at a super high level, I guess, just reallocate or misallocate resources in such a way that is just encouraging the first malincentive. I think the reason I'm not super bothered by this, relative at least to some other Bitcoiners, is that I think this case is often put forward a little bit naively or a little bit out of the appropriate context. And I'll explain what I mean by that. I think that this trend can be resisted, and actually is. I think it's unavoidable, just, you know, observing, even in this, you know, horrible fiat world, right? There are still many institutions, and even more broadly than the institutions themselves, culture at large, that resist this, right? So not literally every single person's vote is bought for the short-termist reasons. Many people are able to escape this to some or other degree. But I think that honing in on that on this reflexive relationship between politics and culture itself. That's really important. I think it's interesting in its own right, actually. It's maybe worth discussing a bit more broadly. I think the reason I'm a bit more positive than a lot of Bitcoiners, let's say, on this, or people who like Hoppe, basically, people who've read Democracy, the God That Failed, which is a very good book, by the way. You should read that. We actually, there's an end note in Bitcoin in Venice telling people to read that book. But the reason I'm a bit more positive than probably Hoppe himself and acolytes, you know, people who like that line of thinking, is that I think I have more faith in the power of culture at large to resist politics. And in particular, there's maybe a really nice segue here that's why Bitcoin's cultural component is so important, because it's good in a far more fundamental economic sense of just not being fiat, right? And your audience have heard this kind of thing a million times, right? But just lowering our time preference and so on. But lending its culture to resistance to these fiat incentives, I think, is really important too. And then maybe there's a good link back to what we were talking about with the connections to Venice. I mean, this is so far removed from what we say in the book, just to be clear. But if anything, that's a good thing. It's fun to tease these things out. That having the, you know, you've got the physical reality at the foundation that then lends itself to political institutions, lends itself to economic institutions, and eventually rises up to culture. I think that's as important in Bitcoin, and that this is probably one of the more important applications of Bitcoin culture, is allowing individuals to push back against this, you know, fiat incentives while they're still unavoidably within a fiat system, which I, you know, is that was part of the premise of the question, right? We are still, we've clearly not hyper Bitcoinized.
Could that, I mean, in say the UAE, could mm-hmm. that be literally the culture of making money, pushing back against the emergence of any kind of political bullshit, let's say?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not at all an expert on contemporary UAE politics, but the comparison to Venice is compelling for sure, because that's basically what happened there. I mean, different structure of the political institution, but the cultural backdrop of, yes, everyone is a merchant, is very, very healthy. And I think that, because you could imagine this in Venice too, right? That political system I described, I claimed it's very, very difficult to game. It's probably not impossible though, right? And this is why I was going out my way to emphasize that living in, you know, it's, you can't just airdrop this mechanism into any society at all. I think it's dependent on it being a mercantile republic, that the culture is one that naturally appreciates positive sum, you know, thinking as much as anything else. It's obviously rooted in more tangible day-to-day like economic affairs, but it then lends itself to thinking about human institutions at large, and that, you know, that is even possible to have positive sum outcomes. But I think that absolutely comes from everybody wanting to make money.
But that's a brilliant title of the book. Everyone is a merchant. It explains the concept of Venice's success really well, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Because that's exactly what you see in Dubai. You see people that...
And the opposite is exactly what you see in fiat as well. I don't mean to be moving away from Dubai so much, but just
I just came back 2 weeks ago, so yeah. It's really fresh in
this
my mind.
This is such a good point that I can't let the opportunity to make it slip by, that one of the... I think this is under-discussed, by the way, what I'm about to mention. I think people natively appreciate it or appreciate the consequences of it, but it's maybe a bit too involved to quite put your finger on. That one of the consequences, one of the many, many horrible consequences of fiat, is artificial bigness, right? Which actually, now I'm thinking about it, probably goes beyond even just the point I was going to make. But
what is it first?
What is
artificial
what?
Bigness?
That institutions are much bigger than they should be, that they are sustained bigger in terms of, well, actually probably in a lot of things, in particular, you know, the number of people that they have involved. The reason being more or less that what fiat gives is essentially the Cantillon effect, right? The closer you are to the money printer, the more distorted your cost of capital is versus your competitors, and then that makes everybody more political than they would otherwise be, as opposed to genuinely competing in a free market. And so the thumb is on the scale of whoever is already big enough to have bought access to the money printer. And so that's all quite kind of intellectual. How that manifests more tangibly is just that there are fewer companies, fewer employers, more to the point, this is where I wanted to go with this, that are much bigger than they would be in a free market if they had to compete with the same cost of capital as everybody else, because they're basically being artificially politically subsidized. And a consequence of this is nobody is a merchant, right? Everybody, well, not maybe not literally everybody, but relative to the counterfactual in which none of that is true, many, many more people are salaried employees. And maybe more, it's not that there's anything necessarily wrong with that, but more to the point, there is no option to be a merchant. You have to, because you can't compete with these artificially big companies, institutions. You have to just, you know, get on the hamster wheel and join the Borg. And then, yeah, I mean, that's the part of the reason I think I wanted to even bring that up, maybe not worth going too off topic on this, but when I introduced it, I mentioned that I do think it's very well understood what some of the consequences of this are, which is why I think people will recognize this point, even without necessarily going through all those steps to articulate it, that a society of very few merchants, very few, you know, business owners or landowners even, is a far more compliant one. It's a far more scared one, because you are not truly independent if you are not controlling your own, well, future, ultimately. I was originally thinking, you know, controlling your own resources, but this is, and obviously that's then exacerbated even further by fiat incentivizing debt. And so the position a lot of people also, you know, which is a form of artificial bigness, I think they're connected. The position a lot of people find themselves in is basically scared to tell the truth. I mean, I don't know, again, this is maybe a little bit too off topic, but during COVID, for example, or I don't even like saying that, during lockdown shenanigans, I feel like then, and this is, it's an interesting time to be talking about this, because a lot of it is coming out, and by which I mean a lot of people are saying what they thought all along, but were scared to say, which maybe doesn't see, you know, that on the face of it, I think seems far more, doesn't seem like it has anything to do with economics. I don't think it's exclusively an economic issue, or, you know, exclusively a quote unquote fiat issue, but I do think it's relevant, certainly relative to the counterfactual in which more people have savings, more people own land, more people own businesses. They are not dependent. They are not scared of saying they think COVID's bullshit, getting fired, being unable to service their debt, getting kicked out their home. Like, you can see how this stuff spirals very quickly if you step out of line, if you are in fact dependent on this this wedge for introducing political attack into economic affairs of you know, fiat induced dependency. So sorry, I didn't want to get too far away from
the
UAE, Dubai, etc. But this, I think this is important. This is good to touch on.
I'm not that bothered about talking about Dubai. It's just that I've just been there, and we've made a film in Dubai literally 2 weeks ago, and I've spoken to hundreds of people about Dubai, and it was interesting to see the complete lack of political things happening there, and realizing, oh my God, yeah. And even the fact
it's because it's incredibly well governed.
Right, exactly.
Basically. Yeah. It's, but, you know, if you, and you can think about it, this is going back to the sovereign individual again, because I'll crassly generalize it and not do it justice. The thesis of the sovereign individual is developments in technology will force states to act more like service providers, because increasingly individuals will be able to resist their violence, hence the whole concept of return on violence, and whether it's just leave or refuse to comply, States will, I mean, probably a lot of them won't, but then they'll just stagnate and regress and maybe even die in some cases. The successful states in, let's say, the 21st century and probably beyond will be the ones who act more like companies. Probably not that are literally companies, I don't know, but or maybe though, I don't know.
Corporations.
Yeah, well, certainly, I think it's tempting to get, in my view, a little bit distracted by the exact legal makeup. It's more, what are their incentives, right? How do they behave? Dubai behaves like a corporation that wants to satisfy its customers. As such, its customers are extremely happy and want no say in management because they're busy living their actual lives, which is great.
Absolutely. All right, then. What rip some holes in the sovereign individual thesis, according to what you think.
I don't think I can. I think it's amazing. I love that book. I recommend everybody read it. Did you have something in mind you expected? No. I disagree with?
No, not at all. No. I get the thesis as well, but I'm acutely aware that I've been believing it for quite a while now, and I do see it playing out. I agree.
Yeah.
You know, but there must be, you know, limit, for example, the limiting movement, you know, like we saw in COVID, you know, when a government sort of stems the movement of people to be able to move to Dubai, say, where they got a better experience of being a sovereign individual.
Yeah.
Things like that are things that we're actually coming up against now. And that's not to say they won't be resolved by over time with the sovereign individual thesis, but they are things that I think about.
Yeah. Well, okay, I think this might be a bit of a cliche or something, but I feel like the thesis of the sovereign individual is far more about the direction than the destination. I don't know if that's a helpful way of describing it, in that, at least as far, it's been a while since I read it, but as far as I remember, they don't say, you know, by X time, Y will have happened. It's more the more time goes on, the more likely these things will be to happen. And in the very, very long run, it gets more and more certain. But obviously, there's going to be blips on the way. I mean, one thing I do actually remember that they say quite clearly, I think this is one of the more favorite excerpts. I don't know it off by heart, but I can, you know, probably some of the audience does, is there's a paragraph or two where they talk about how, as this becomes more obvious, states will react to it. And I think the reason it's famous or became more famous recently is that one of the things they mention is travel restrictions on phony medical grounds. I don't think they word it exactly that way, but it's kind of scary how prescient it was. They basically say COVID, right? They say what happened. Sorry. They say lockdown shenanigans. They say what happened.
Restricted
during
travel.
Yeah. Lockdown shenanigans.
Yeah.
I mean, even that is, I can't find much to disagree with, at least from what I remember from that book.
You're not a fan of the word plandemic then? Is that too far?
I just think it's not a good meme. It's weak.
Okay, then everyone is a merchant. I'm going to come back to that because I thought that was really interesting. And no one is a merchant, being the antithesis, which I presume something like communism would be.
Oh yeah, that's an obvious extreme of it, where they just you're not allowed to be. It's not even that the incentives are such that you shouldn't. You just can't.
What about then? Overlaying that over the Bitcoin thesis, how does everyone is a merchant or no one is a merchant fit into the Bitcoin thesis?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So there's a lot of things in describing the changes I think Bitcoin will make, however gradually, where I actually find it easier to not focus so much on Bitcoin. I think this is a theme of the book too. This is why I kind of joke that like Bitcoin is clickbait. It's in the background as relevant, but it's not really our focus. Basically, because I think, at least for me, it's easier to understand the problems as being fiat problems. It's not like we have these problems because we don't have Bitcoin. It's really, well, it is, but more in the sense of we don't have sound money. It's like, what is the result of having fiat money? And once you understand them, or at least once I think I have understood some of them, it's easier to conceive of the progress that Bitcoin will offer as simply undoing all these things. So it's more like return to a more natural state rather than, I don't mean to like straw man it or caricature anybody, but, you know, I guess it could alternatively be framed as, you know, progressing to like more utopian, basically, right? Which I resist, in part because I think it's more difficult to understand. Also in part because I think it makes it seem less realistic than it probably is. I actually, this is an interesting point. I quite dislike, I wish I could think of a good example of this. I know they're out there, but there's a lot of memes in Bitcoin that strike me at least as being quite utopian, right? Like we're going to enter a new, or maybe even I'm guilty of this in terms of saying things like, oh, we're gonna have a new renaissance, right? And like linking it to Venice and so on. But, you know, we're gonna have some kind of unprecedented change, or, well, destination, right? Rather than just a direction, which I don't think is really helpful. I mean, in part, I think it's just inaccurate, but more what I'm getting at is like as a meme, I don't think it's good advertising. One of the things I really like doing, I don't think this is relevant so much to the book. Actually, no, it is. It just in a more roundabout way. So one of the points that we want to try to, I guess, like subliminally communicate with the book is that we don't talk about Bitcoin that much in the foreground because we want the reader to come away. And I think this is kind of what Tour was getting at. He might not have worded it this way, but I think this is kind of the point he was picking up on. We want the reader to come away appreciating the importance of Bitcoin completely without reference to Bitcoin. We want the reader to appreciate the kind of institutions that are healthy and the kind of incentives that are healthy to build those institutions in the first place, and appreciate that as more of the goal. And then realize that Bitcoin is a tool to achieve that rather than being an end in itself. And so that is the kind of meme, the kind of advertising that I prefer, in large part because I think it's easier to appeal to people that way, because there's a lot of ways of talking about Bitcoin, which are true, right? They're accurate enough. I just don't think they're super helpful in certain contexts. But that are playing it up as novel technology, right? It's, and I think, aside from anything else, that then lends itself to all kinds of crypto bullshit because it's lacking exactly the nuance that I'm trying to communicate here. I think there's a far better case to be made, even though that is, you know, you can say those things in a way that is still true. But in terms of advertising it to people, there's a far, far better case to be made arguing that Bitcoin is actually really old, or at least that the idea is really old. And if anything, it's fiat that is new, and it's fiat that it's the novelty of fiat that's a disaster. And we're just, what Bitcoin lets us do is undo that.
It just made me think, actually. I'm thinking about the evolution of fiat. Mm. And I'm thinking also about the digital realm, which is also very novel, as mm-hmm. you said. And I'm wondering whether they aren't very interconnected. I'll tell you what I mean. Bitcoin has been discovered because we've discovered the digital realm. Like we could never have worked that out without this new territory. Yeah. This, you know, we're there now. Arguably, the fiat world is magnified by the ability to operate in this realm. Do you think?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. So are they connected? I mean, is that like you can see why the fiat system evolved. It mm-hmm. makes sense, you know, gold bars, tokens, blah, you know. But when you get this new frontier that appears, the digital realm that we've never had access to before, and all of a sudden now there's like this, and you jump in there with fiat, you can rule.
Yeah.
Literally. Yeah. But there's this natural discovery of the antidote to mm-hmm. fiat. Mm-hmm. Does that make any sense?
No, I definitely think it does. It's given me two ideas I'll mention. So the first one is that I highly, highly recommend Broken Money by Lynn Alden. I'm sure probably most of your audience is aware of this anyway.
I haven't read it.
You've got to read it. So this is the thing. Like everybody knows about it, but you've got to read it. Right. Basically because she gives a framework for appreciating both the significance of Bitcoin and the historical significance of fiat that is in no way normative. It's just actually, so she definitely doesn't describe it this way, but I think she'd probably agree with my summary of it, that it is grounded in physical reality. And I think this is something that probably not even Bitcoiners, but maybe more Austrians would really appreciate. I actually think it's a novel academic contribution to monetary theory. I really can't praise this book enough. On account of giving a theory, I suppose, that very compellingly describes why fiat won, right? Why it was successful. I won't be able to do it justice now, but I guess a very short version would be that the digital realm, by which I think it's important to clarify, that's not the internet as such, it's more telecommunications, but obviously the internet, you know, massively accelerates that. But telecommunications makes payments, or it enables modalities of payment that are so much faster than what could possibly be kept up with by basically gold. But if you want to think about it a bit more abstractly, you know, any physically scarce thing that you're using as money. And obviously prior to Bitcoin, gold is the best example of this that we knew about. That the temptation to utilize that and to start to trust it, because obviously the important caveat being that you require a trusted third party to facilitate these payments, but the short term or almost immediate, the immediate economic utility of shifting to trusting third parties to facilitate payments in this incredibly quick way is compelling, and people do it, and in the long run we're all screwed. But it's what I really like about, and obviously, you know, read the book, it's hundreds of pages long explaining this far, you know, far better than I did in that minute or two or whatever, but it's attractive, I think, because there's no conspiracy involved, right? You don't need to say that, and it's kind of beside the point that maybe historically there were in fact conspiracies that contributed to this, but it's a lot, I think, easier to understand and probably just historically accurate to describe why this evolution was natural, right? And largely market driven, actually. I think that's a point that a lot of Austrians get, or maybe less so Bitcoiners, but Austrians get kind of hung up on and annoyed about, and very pedantic about, you know, unhelpfully pedantic about exactly what role government had in this, and, you know, therefore what was or wasn't the market. It is kind of, in my view, it's kind of beside the point. And I think Lynn's analysis is basically spot on. It's one of these things, like, I really can't speak highly enough of this book, because it's one of the very few books I've read and being mad I didn't write it. It's like, this is just perfectly clarified for me everything I was thinking, but badly, right? Everything that I hadn't yet figured out how to articulate, but I felt like I knew, like, it's in this book.
What does she say then about the emergence of Bitcoin?
So it's very little of the book is about Bitcoins. Maybe the final, I forget exactly how the chapters are broken down, but I want to say the final 10 or 20% moves on to talking about Bitcoin. That's, I think she has to do that to round the whole thesis off and make it appealing to Bitcoiners, because she's very carefully constructed this framework for evaluating the relative merits of monies, not just normatively. I think that's the key, right? Not just why people might like them, or they might, most of the things we've been talking about, basically, like why it's good for, you know, quote unquote, good for society at large, but more rooted in physical reality and acknowledging incentives. Why do people actually use it, and how does that progress the institutions that are involved? But she set up this framework so well, in so much careful detail, that actually she doesn't really need to spend that much time talking about Bitcoin, because all of the things to say about it are then obvious, in that, and this is going right back to your question, that part of the reason, she doesn't put it this way, I'm kind of romanticizing it to tie it in with the question, but part of the reason that Bitcoin has so much promise is that it is natively digital and hence addresses all of these problems, arguably even better than fiat does in terms of, again, grounding it in physical reality, whilst having the, you know, back to my earlier point, whilst having the actually much older quality of being a sound money that we've somewhat lost in the meantime.
Does that mean, I mean, is this just the battle between, this is an age old battle, which just happening, it's happening in a new frontier, right? The digital frontier. Right?
Yeah, that, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. It's opened. I mean, everything else has as well. Like, mm-hmm. it used to be a Wild West, the digital realm. Mm-hmm. And now people are coming in trying to censor it, to control
yeah.
it. To,
yeah.
You know, and that's interesting. I think I probably need to read that book. Does she? So, without talking about someone else's book all the time.
I don't mind. I'm very happy to do the marketing for Broken Money.
Tell me about the benefits of the fiat system then, and whether or not they're just relative to the time that we live in.
Am I going to get cancelled for answering this question?
You know what I mean, though?
Like, no, I wouldn't say...
You said the market chose this.
Kind of. You got to be careful with that. So I want to rephrase the question, if you don't mind, because I don't think there are any benefits to the fiat system. I'm kind of immediately getting wary of being cancelled, even addressing, like even acknowledging the question. No, I mean, jokes aside... I think a better way of putting it is, what are the, well, first of all, clarifying. So to me, the fiat system, I would normally interpret that in a much, much wider context that most of our conversation has been about, right? It's like everything, basically society at large and how all the different institutions are affected by the presence of fiat. What Lynn talks about, and I think what's relevant to, especially to the comparison as monies, are its properties in terms of financial intermediation. And so you're asking what are the benefits there? That I think is a perfectly fair question. This is what Lynn analyzes in a lot more detail than, you know, we'll be able to talk about or that I'll even remember probably. Basically that the idea of, I'll get a little bit philosophical for a second, but then try to tie it back. The idea of making a payment, which is obviously pretty intrinsic to money, right? It's not just, you know, saving it doesn't really mean anything unless you are expecting to be able to spend it at some point. So the idea of spending money, completely in the abstract, you would think of as essentially about information. Right. And so you can get into, I don't think it's super helpful for this, but just to tie it to some concepts people will probably have thought about before, be familiar with, you know, money is time, right? Or money, maybe even money is essentially itself information. One of the more helpful concepts that Lynn introduces is the idea of money being a ledger, which it's not her idea, obviously, but the way she frames it, I think is super helpful because she categorizes every type of money. I mean, mainly just focuses on gold and then fiat and then Bitcoin, but contrasts their properties as ledgers. And so the properties of fiat as a ledger are mostly terrible, other than payments flow. So, but relative to gold, obviously not relative to Bitcoin, so with, you know, historically appropriate. If you think of a payment, which I think you, not only you should, but probably most people just do, as something that more or less should happen instantly because it's just an exchange of information and it's quite literally an updating of a ledger, it takes a really long time to update the ledger of who owns what gold. And actually, even by the point that what it's fair to call fiat was introduced, there's multiple stages over which it evolves. It's not, you know, a clean, like, oh, now we have fiat. Even by then, the reason it was able to make ground, by and large, is that gold itself, as a money, had been more or less reduced to, you know, the backing of fiduciary media rather than anybody actually moving gold around. And, you know, Bitcoiners are perfectly familiar with that whole thesis. I don't need to explain that. What Fiat offers, and actually, sorry, there's one more point that Lynn very helpfully analyzes, is that the historical circumstances around technology as a whole, I think, are super important to this as well. I think this is maybe the best contribution, at least in my mind, in terms of being, you know, a really valuable resource to economic history, that I think she's provided with all of this analysis, is being aware of the circumstances of technology at the time, which is important. I mean, it's important for any good economic history, I guess, but in particular, because I think something that has always bugged me, just in general, I suppose, but which I also feel like Austrians ought to appreciate better than they maybe do, certainly relative to other, you know, schools of economics that they largely don't like, is that money itself is, to my mind, pretty obviously a kind of institution, right? And it doesn't just exist in a vacuum. It relies on, again, physical reality. It relies on culture to some extent, or, you know, the makeup of the institutions in which it is being used. There's historical factors that matter enormously to how money even can work, never mind how it, you know, quote unquote, should work. So one of the extremely helpful insights that Lynn provides is recognizing that when telecommunications technology took off, all of a sudden, quite quickly over, you know, the historical period in which this happened, people engaged in commerce, I'd say businesses, let's say, right? Businesses were able to communicate far, far faster than they were able to physically move. And this was historically new, right? So in like Venice, for example, money was largely gold. The Venetian, I actually don't know how to pronounce this. I mean, put myself on the spot. I think it's ducat, but maybe ducat. I don't know. I don't speak Italian. I know how to spell it. The Venetian ducat was, not only was it gold, but it was, you know, heralded quite literally throughout the world, but the civilizations with which Venice had any contact as the standard store of value. It was basically to the extent you could say there was a global reserve currency. For a couple of hundred years, it was it. And then obviously that moved on over time with Venice's relative decline. That said, there were still, I mean, this is actually quite pivotal to the economic history of Venice, to even to Bitcoin as Venice. It's one of the things we talk about, that as in that article, that chapter. There were banking institutions in Venice, which you'd probably expect, as you know, that's kind of part and parcel with the economic flourishing. But they obviously worked in a very, very different way to today, in part because, you know, they actually took it seriously that gold was sound money, which we don't really anymore, but also because of these technological factors, right? The financial intermediation was itself constrained by how fast you could pass this information around, right? So you think of, again, going back to, you think of payments as basically just exchanging information. That matters enormously if the fastest you can get information anywhere is, you know, the speed of a horse or the speed of a ship. So when that changed to the speed of light, suddenly there's enormous incentives for arranging commercial activity, I'll say, by taking advantage of telecommunications. And this is kind of a cliche with the internet, right? That like, oh, it's just changed everything about how we communicate, blah, blah, blah. But the effect itself, I think, massively predates us by over 100 years. And so it's around the time that the organization of business itself starts to shift to suddenly orders of magnitude faster than had ever previously been, you know, even conceivable, that the people involved in this business start to wonder, well, why can't money move this fast too? Like, that's a major bottleneck to these newfound commercial powers that we have. Or, you know, powers, I don't mean that in a malicious way, you know, abilities. And so that's, you know, kind of rounding off Lynn's thesis around the evolution of money and the relevance of the ledgers, is that probably more so, arguably, than anything nefariously political, although there are obviously components of that. But that is probably the most important catalyst to really severing the connection between the informational side of money actually having any backing in scarcity. And so the way Lynn frames it is it's an evolution in how the ledger works that everybody is using as money, which to some extent, this is why I'm kind of hesitating to fully agree with the way you framed the question, to some extent was market driven, not entirely, but not at all either. I think that is an important component to
it. Do you happen to know to what extent Venice used any kind of token for its gold?
What do you mean by token?
As in, moving small gold coins around is fine, but what about mm-hmm. large transactions?
Oh, well, that's why the Venetian financial system is so interesting, that they in world economic history, they pioneered basically everything that we now just take for granted.
But so what, why, go back over then the reason why that system didn't turn into a fiat system. Like, what was stopping the same
good question.
The same stuff happening then in over a thousand years? Because in a way you were hinting that it was the culture that stopped it.
In large part culture, yeah.
So what's changed now then? Like, why do people jump so quickly into the treading on other people? Like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't.
It sounds like culture of honor. It's more like a culture of honor.
Well, I mean culture in a slightly different way. I think that's probably relevant too, what you're hinting at. The sense in which I think culture is relevant to this question is more, it's maybe more something like expectations or, you know, willingness to tolerate certain behavior. I mean, if you tried to go fractional reserve in Venice, I don't even know what would happen. I mean, it didn't occur to anybody to do it because it's just obviously wrong, basically.
So why did it occur to someone in the 21st century then?
Yes, good question. I mean, I think, well, just to clarify, I don't want this to sound too binary. The fractional reserve evolved over a very, very long, like literally hundreds of years. Well, it predates fiat as well. It is fractional reserve on a gold standard. The question is just, it's a combination of, okay, well, how immune is the financial system to bank runs and how supported by the state, which is why I'm, you know, emphasizing it's not entirely market driven, how supported by the state in artificially resisting that pressure and, you know, staying sovereign while debasing. There's a lot more variables than just like, oh, do people want to be more fiat or not? Just to link back to the previous question, though, there suddenly becomes a massive incentive to, at least relatively more than previously, go fractional reserve if you can. I don't know if calling it digitization is probably confusing because that suggests the internet. But again, if you can communicate far, far faster, it dramatically changes, for example, how you would expect a letter of credit with a Venetian family bank to work if, you know, you can just send a telegraph rather than sending an agent to Bruges, I don't know, far away.
Maybe it was a case of if it ain't broke, don't fix it, because the families that ran Venice were successful for a very long mm-hmm. time. Mm-hmm. And arguably they just...
Well, they also had bank failures, though. That's another thing, that there was... This is arguably cultural, and it's arguably to do with the mercantile component, again, that they not only appreciated... It's sort of weird to construct this in the negative, like it just wouldn't have occurred to them to do such a thing because it's so obviously wrong. There's also another component, though, which is that they understood how valuable having the ducat was in, I guess you'd call it geopolitics. It's a bit weird in that much more limited context, but just politics, external, you know, foreign affairs, right? And that gave them significant economic power. This time I do mean it as power, ability, but also power, that were they to debase, they would lose. And they didn't want that because, and this is maybe a really fascinating tie-in actually, that they didn't want it because they were all merchants, right? there's no point debasing to like buy votes. I mean, you couldn't have done that anyway, but just in theory, there's no point. You could have done an equivalent, I guess. They could have debased to appease the population regardless of, you know, governance model, just, you know, have parties all the time or whatever. But they didn't because, well, for a lot of reasons, I guess culture kind of captures all of them. They were
decentralized as
they
well.
Partly they were decentralized. They lacked...
Everyone, there was always someone being successful.
You know, well, there's always almost everyone being successful.
Right, okay. But in a way, there was no need to fractionally... Yeah, there's no need to print money when you're making a lot of money, is there? And you want to continue doing it. And everyone, say they were of these, I'm thinking back to the way that they were structuring their governance. If one or two families failed, it doesn't matter if you've got this group of families who are all deciding, look, this thing still works. Let's just keep it going. You failed, you played by the rules, you lost, that's fine, you know. Mm.
I think another component, I've just realized this in the meantime, by the way, is that it's again, I think, due to ability to, like how communications works and hence how you organize business in the first place. This is somewhat hypothetical. I don't know if, I'm kind of making this up, but I think it stands to reason that there would have been so significantly greater a risk of a devastating bank run were they to try to fractionally reserve. I mean, in large part because I don't think it even really makes sense because they didn't have fiduciary media. They had paper money to an extent, but it was primarily letters of credit from individual merchants, which are basically like IOUs to redeem the real money at a bank. And that lends itself to a lot of financial transactions being literally rearrangement of bank ledgers. So there's you know, thriving financial system in Venice. They quite literally invented a lot of what we now completely take for granted. But all because of the, and I'm trying to like use the, I'm trying to describe this in such a way as that the link to what I was talking about with broken money is clearer. Predicated on forms of business that, or ways of doing business, doesn't even really matter what the business is, that in no way incentivized a move in a more fiat direction. You know, the banks themselves were merely service providers around money, around, you know, making money more useful, making, which ultimately just really means making it easier to do business. There was no notion that they created the money. The mint created the money, right? The money was gold, sort of. Well, the specie was gold. It had value because it was gold. It had legal merit because the mint decreed it so. But this is all very closely connected, obviously, because the equivalent then wouldn't have been, you know, banks printing money, because that doesn't, like, literally doesn't mean anything. It would have been debasement, right? It would have been the mint, you know, reducing the gold content of the ducat or you know, something along those lines. And it didn't happen because of culture, to put it very, very simply, and probably kind of inaccurately, but for the purposes of time, you know, there's whole very, very long books about this kind of thing. Actually, this is a great opportunity to show this, one of which is by Frederick Lane. So if you remember him, he's very heavily cited in The Sovereign Individual. He's an economic historian who talks a lot about returns on violence. But one of his, the book of his that I like the most, I'm now not going to remember what it's called. It was co-written with another economic historian called Frederick Muller. That's probably enough to go find it, but it's, I think it's Venetian Money Markets. Very, very good. It's like 600 pages or something. It's incredibly detailed. I kind of suspect that I'm one of the few people who's actually read it. but I encourage, if you're into this sort of thing, if you want to think about, and I'll wrap up on this because this is a great connection to make, that literally the reason I read this book, or like found him, well, I found, you know, Lane from sort of an individual, but the reason I went in this direction in my reading, which then produced Bitcoin is Venice not too long after that, was going down this rabbit hole of, if you had actually sound money, how would financial institutions have to work? And hopefully we've now covered enough that the connection should be obvious, right? That in Venice, in medieval Venice, early Renaissance Venice, they did have sound money. They also had all the other properties where, you know, saying are positive and you know, hoping for eventually returning with Bitcoin. I guess in particular, the stability lending itself to economic growth, which in turn is related, you know, the financial intermediation is an important component of that. But that environment being, I think, a very helpful comparison. And so, you know, whenever this was 4 years ago or something, I was like, I want to read everything that has been sensibly written about this. And I find this incredibly obscure book that, if your audience is as interested as I am, I would highly encourage going to read.
Okay, then. we'll wrap up in this area, okay? What do you think, what can we learn about threats to the Bitcoin ecosystem from, say, the decline of Venice?
Oh, that's super interesting. Yeah, I mean, that's quite dramatically shifting the historical period. So Venice, again, very, very briefly, Venice surrendered to Napoleon in, I believe, 1800. I might get the year slightly off. And that ended the over 1,000-year independence of the Republic. But basically the reason that happened was changes in military technology. The physical reality of their very easily defensible position simply changed. And, and that's the way things go sometimes. So what can we learn? I'm not sure we really can learn anything. I guess it's more we can yet again appreciate the importance of, whether you want to think of it as returns to violence or the physical reality that sets up whatever cultural factors, whatever social institutions, you know, you might want, but also are even possible, and how you incentivize them. I guess that's worth being aware of. I'm not sure there's really anything to learn, because it's kind of sad in a way. You know, it was this 1,000 years of mercantile republic just destroyed by a militaristic empire. It's not my favorite period in history.
Could be the lesson, I suppose. But go on then. Do you see any threats to Bitcoin yourself?
Oh yeah, definitely. I kind of feel like I'm not really the best qualified person to talk about this, because I think the more credible answers are quite technical, at least as far as I'm aware. I know a lot of people get irritated with the, you know, oh, Bitcoin is inevitable meme, and that, you know, implying, I guess, that there's a lot of work that needs to be done, which I agree with, in the sense that, yes, it's, you know, as we've covered in a lot of contexts here, it's a social institution. It requires, you know, there's no Bitcoin without people, maybe one way of putting it. I am actually quite drawn to the idea that it just is inevitable, though. But even there, that is better understood, at least the way I understand it, as being more about undoing fiat than being about Bitcoin necessarily. I kind of feel like fiat is imploding. Like fiat cannot possibly, it's defined by its unsustainability, and Bitcoin also exists. Therefore, to some extent, I feel like it is inevitable. But yeah, I think there are threats to it. But I guess where I'm going with all of this is that I honestly don't see any truly existential threats. I think the worst a threat can do, maybe it depends on your time preference. That's a good way of putting it. The worst a threat can do is delay it. And it could, I mean, that's not to downplay some of what I would think of the more serious threats. It could delay it by an enormous amount of time. It could delay it such that, you know, maybe it doesn't happen in my lifetime, which otherwise it might have. So it's not that the threats aren't serious. It's just that I think the incentives are such that in the long run, it has to win. It can't fail to win in the long enough time horizon. The question is just, you know, what's acceptable?
Can you see any, you're saying Fiat's imploding. Hmm. What's your most likely scenario?
I really don't know. And I would be intensely skeptical of anybody who does claim to know, because I feel like this is sort of stepping back a little bit. This is, I think, ultimately a question of economic methodology. This is something we do discuss in the book quite early on. It's not super related to anything we've covered in this conversation. But if you are, it's a very Austrian point, right? That if you're thinking properly about economics or macroeconomics, you have to be humble enough to recognize, I guess one way of putting it would be the complexity of the system. That's a little bit technical, I guess. In more, I guess, layman's terms, that all economic activity, no matter how aggregated, follows from individual human action. The individual actions are necessarily unpredictable, certainly not modelable. Then their aggregation will be even worse. It's not like you can just cancel the noise and take the median or something, which I think is more or less the mainstream fiat, you know, Keynesian, if you want to call it that, neoclassical view. I think Austrians think is just complete nonsense. So to go back to your question, though, if that is in fact your attitude of how the aggregate of economic activity works, especially, it gets even worse if you then introduce fiat, because it's kind of more noise than anything else. It's, you've got this inherently uncertain as opposed to risky. I like that, we talk about that in the book. That's a section of one of the chapters, like just being clear on what that difference means. You know, you have this uncertain, inherently unpredictable system that you're then pumping noise into with fiat. Who knows? Like, really, who knows? I don't mean that rhetorically so much as I don't think anybody knows. I think anyone who claims to know is probably bullshitting. So sorry, it's kind of anticlimactic as an answer, but it's if anything, I think it actually lends itself even better to being pro Bitcoin, because if you could know, you probably wouldn't need Bitcoin to, I mean, at a very personal level, right? Like if you'd figured out how fiat was going to collapse, you could just plan accordingly and probably wouldn't need Bitcoin for that. But the fact that you can't, in my view, is part of what is so scary about it. And if anything, Bitcoin is kind of a form of insurance against that, right? As I, again, just referring to the conference that we're at just now, the videos will come out at some point, I guess, in the next couple of days. But I was on a, separate to the talk that I gave, I was on a panel where Jack Mallers said, I think this is an exact quote, but I really liked it. So I'll memorize it once it does come out and I see it again, that Bitcoin is a put option on fiat collapsing, which I think is true, but is also, you know, it's kind of a rhetorically effective way of capturing this point.
Other than, just one final question on that same point, other than stacking sats, how else are you signaling your expectation of fiat collapse? I'm talking about things like prepping and living in the, I mean, you know, like, yeah. 'Cause that's the best way, I think, to see how people feel about things like this and what they actually think is, what are they doing in there?
So I have an answer to this that I think is, I can imagine a lot of Bitcoiners not liking this, but just I'm prefacing it to say that this is personal to me. This isn't, I'm not prescribing this for anybody else. So I'm also not, therefore, you know, throwing shade on anybody else's approach to this. But I, for my situation, don't really see much value in prepping as such. And I think it's more to do with what my attitude is to not only what I think is likely to happen with Bitcoin, but why I even care in the first place. Like, why, I guess in some sense, why even am I a Bitcoiner? I think, I'm trying to think of a good, like, kind of a clean way of putting this. I am far more interested in getting to a point where we live on a Bitcoin standard than watching my Bitcoin appreciate. And I realize that that may come across as, but probably some people just don't believe me, right? Which I totally get. They might think that that's just disingenuous and, you know, kind of virtue signaling or whatever. And I would try to convince anyone who has reacted that way that I don't at all mean that as a, I mean, I would encourage anyone else to try to have that attitude too. I don't mean it as a virtue signal or anything. And it's also not to say that it's like, oh, I just don't care. Right. It's like, oh, I'm not even stacking sats in the first place because who cares? That's obviously not the point. It's, you know, there's a whole well understood, well discussed rationale of how important it is that actually there is a selfish motivation for this. So the point I'm making is not at all that, oh, I'm perfectly selfless. It's more that the end goal for me is, and the reason, you know, I kind of want this to happen as quickly as possible is that I just want to live in that world, right? I'm not particularly, I think there's also a component, just to go right back to the question, there's a component of honestly feeling kind of powerless against the collapse of fiat. I think it's inevitable. Like it is imploding. It is clearly unsustainable. I'm not sure what I can do, if anything, to make its implosion less traumatic. I think all I can really do is ensure that I will be okay and that my family will be okay. And to some people that means prepping, sure. To me, I think it's more just about, I guess this is a nice way of putting it. To me, it's more about human capital. So I think you could, probably most people wouldn't, this is a very like overly rhetorical way of describing it, but prepping as such is about accumulating the physical capital that you think you'll need when fiat wipes out all the other things that people rely on. And I get the appeal of that. I am honestly more interested for me personally, I'm more interested in ensuring that I will always be able to create value for others such that I'll probably be okay. But the faster we get to a Bitcoin standard, the easier I think that will be. That's maybe one interesting, I'm not sure how much this applies to me directly, but that's one interesting way of thinking about, I guess, the difference between the systems and why fiat is so objectionable is that it really distorts, but this is back to like, nobody's a merchant, right? It really distorts your ability to add value to others in a way that you'll be appropriately rewarded for. So that's more my attitude towards it, that I want to ensure that I can always either add value for others or just, you know, directly for myself.
Well, that's an interesting answer. I mean, maintaining networks of human capital. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to sum it up like that, which is definitely a part of, one of a better word, prepping. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that I think most preppers would also include, you know, growing your own food, raising your own animals, you know, you know, these kind of things. But your idea would be make sure that within that network of human capital.
I mean, I wouldn't mind doing those things. It's just, it's honestly not a priority for me at the moment.
That's what I mean, though. By that, in that sense, you're signaling that you think you've got time to prepare that aspect.
I think it's softer than that, because even there, that suggests that I have some kind of knowledge about the collapse. Like, fiat could collapse tomorrow, for all I know. It's more just, what do I find, like, how am I choosing to allocate my time now? I think is more the point.
I keep thinking of things, sorry. I was talking yesterday with somebody about hyperinflation in, mm-hmm. They lived through the hyperinflation event in Buenos Aires in Argentina. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about not seeing the signs. It just seemed relevant there when we were talking about fiat collapse.
So I tell you what, though, I can round this off in a really nice way, right? If it wasn't for Bitcoin, I would absolutely be a prepper. Like, there's no doubt about that whatsoever. I think that's probably like an important missing piece of context in all of this, that it's precisely because I have Bitcoin, you know, before losing it all in the boating accident, right? That it's a put option on fiat collapsing. It's insurance. It's, well, it's real money as well, but it's also monetizing. Like, that is all obviously incredibly important. That's probably, I should have mentioned that earlier in terms of emphasizing again the selfish component to it. If that, I think about this often, actually, just a bit more generally than we're discussing now, how depressing it would be knowing everything we know about fiat and not having Bitcoin. Because there are people who went through that, for sure. I mean, anyone with remotely Austrian or cypherpunk even tendencies, literally prior to Bitcoin, probably any time from, depends, 1971, I guess, but maybe, you know, Safe has this joke, well, kind of half joke about how Bitcoin is the technology that will finally end the First World War, right? Like, there are a lot of people who, because of their knowledge, ended up leading, I wouldn't say hopeless, but certainly relatively more hopeless than for us, because we have this life raft. I think about that a lot.
Me too. I think that's a good way to end, actually. It is a life raft.
Yeah.
Alan, thanks. I was going to say,
yeah, thank
one,
you so
from
much.
One Alan to another. The strange thing about your name is it's the same spelling as my surname. We normally have Alan, A-L-A-N.
Yeah, that's this happens to me all the time.
Is that a Scottish thing or something?
No, so it's, I mean, it's basically, it's not common at all. Everybody always misspells my name. It's what it, you're right, it's what it would be if it were a surname, but for, it's just not, it's just
is
how
that
mine's
just
spelled.
Your mum and dad being a bit crazy and saying, let's call him, you know.
Guess so, yeah.
Well, anyway, from one end to another, thank you. Thanks for coming in and
no, thank
appreciate
you.
It. Thank you.